The College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Negandhi.
And welcome to the College Football Podcast. Kirk Herbstreit and Kevin Negandhi with you. We hope you had a great holiday with family and friends, social distancing, whether it's together in your home or whether it's through Zoom or conversations via FaceTime or on the phone. And we hope your loved ones are safe and healthy. If you enjoy the podcast, another reminder, subscribe, rate, and review. We'd love to hear the feedback. It's always good for us. And, you know, we're in the middle of bowl season. And this is, Herbie, I feel like it's okay to say we've made it because this is the final podcast of 2020 as we look forward to what's coming up later on this week in the college football playoff semifinal. And happy holidays to you and the fam.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I know we were just talking before we came on. You had quite a Christmas day, but thankfully everybody's safe. And boy, there was a scare in Nashville, you know, everybody, that was national news with a bombing, you know, Christmas morning. So what again, strange time, strange year. I'm just glad you're okay. Your family's okay. Well, it sounds like you guys had quite an ordeal, but happy holidays to you and your family as well.
I appreciate that. Yeah, we just a minor thing. We had a lot of rain in the area and then suddenly caused a leak in the kitchen. And that's never fun on Christmas Day. And then suddenly you're dealing with insurance claims, roofers, as well as restoration in the house. But everybody's good. And it's a good for us to kind of put a spin to, hey, we're very lucky that we are safe and healthy on a day like this. And you know what? Before we even move forward, I want to say congratulations to your son and to the Herbstreit family. The idea that he can go get the next chance to play at Ohio State and continue the Herbstreit tradition, that's got to be a fantastic moment for him over the holidays.
Yeah, that was a really cool day. It's been a weird year to be a guy who's getting recruited and looked at, and you know, you're not really able to go to games, not really able to get on campuses. And he's not, you know, a five-star kind of guy. He's kind of a guy that there were some schools looking at potentially making some offers. And his heart was always set on Ohio State. And Ohio State was constantly in communication with him throughout the entire year with a few of the coaches. And so it became more and more enticing to him and more of a reality. And then the day I think he went on social media, announced it. Coach Day had reached out to him and made him an offer to join Ohio State as a preferred walk on, and he was elated. And he, you know, Coach Day was like, "Run into get your parents. I want them to be able to hear this too." And you know, Coach Day was all fired up about it. And you know, for our family, you're right. I mean, I have two sons right now, identical twins that are at Clemson, but my dad played at Ohio State for Woody Hayes and was a captain. Going back to 1960, the very next year he was secondary coach. They didn't do GAs back then. He was secondary coach with Bo Schembechler on the staff and Woody Hayes. And Bo got the Miami job and took my dad down to be part of that as a defensive coordinator. So my dad was right in the thick of it. And then I came along and was a college football junkie, just with those names being my family history. And I played at Ohio State and I was a captain in 1992. And my wife's a cheerleader. So, you know, we're about as Ohio State as you can imagine. And then I end up doing the job that I have and love Ohio State. And contrary to what I get accused of from some fans, and two sons ended up going to Clemson. And then Zach came along. He's got a bigger size, more like me. He's about 6'3", 220, 225, and going in anyway. And he's going to go in as like an H-back, fullback, tight end type of player. But, you know, all of a sudden they offer him that opportunity to go to Ohio State. And it was pretty cool to think about third generation Buckeye in our family. And he's stoked, fired up for the opportunity and looking forward to moving up there in June and becoming part of the Buckeye family.
I want to wish Zach the best of luck. That is pretty cool for him. I can't even imagine as a father, as a family and a parent, to see the tradition continue, how amazing that is. And we will be rooting for him, of course, as his career moves on.
Appreciate that very much.
So, you know, we're in the middle of, you know, everything we're doing is, it feels like we could say interesting, right? A bowl season where we don't have all the bowls being played. So, you know, this was ahead of time. Nearly a dozen bowl games were canceled just because of the environment and the situation. The timing as well, I go back to, I said this over the weekend when we were doing some halftime stuff on ABC, is, you know, what's different from this year and previous years too is your conference championship games are ending that first weekend of December, and then you have that 3 to 4 weeks in preparation to get your body and your mind mentally set into the playoff. We do not have that here. When you look at the four teams in the conversation, they've got 13 days to prepare for a playoff game. And for some, that could work to their advantage. For others, and I look at Ohio State, where they had 22 players miss out in the Northwestern game. When you hear that time frame, what kind of role do you think that could play in these two semifinal matches?
You know, I think as coaches and players, whether it was in the old BCS era, where I can't remember if it was 30 days off or 40 days off. I remember it used to be a big story about, man, how do you maintain your rhythm with such a long layoff, you know, from the conference championship game to all the bowl games to finally getting to the BCS championship game that in many cases was like January 9th or 10th, and it was a long layoff. And or a year like this, where it's a little bit quicker of a turnaround, coaches who are routine oriented in every phase of their life and every month in the calendar year, and they've always had a routine. They've always known what February is. They've always known what April is. They've always known what July is. They just know, you know, like it's just built into them. Everything has been scrapped and they've had this kind of start over. And I think that more than anything has really challenged these coaches to try to build a new schedule and a new set of routines for their players. What I've learned in watching this is no matter what comes their way, you're almost in your own mind like a Navy SEAL. You know, it's like whether it's a 12-day layoff, 12 days is perfect. Here we go. This is what we're going to do. Or it's a, you know, an 8-day, no problem, 8 days. It's just you adjust your positivity or whatever your set of circumstances are to make it as if this is what we wanted all along. Here we go. You know, and that's how you sell it to your players. And then your players adjust accordingly to whatever they're told. You know, as players, we're kind of robots. We're really, I used to look at it like we're in the Marines. You know, you get your itinerary, you're told what to do, you read the board, you wait, you lift weights at this time, you go eat at this time, you go to meeting rooms, you get, you know, your film study, you're out on the practice field, back to study more film. I mean, that's kind of your world as a player. And so I'm sure the players and the coaches, once they found out the schedule, they quickly laid out, here's what we're going to do. We'll give you a day and a half off for Christmas or whatever. You know, I think Nick Saban gave him like, I think 2.5, 3 days off. Mm-hmm. So whatever the plan is, it is. And then you attack it. And I don't know at the end of the day if it's going to have a whole lot to do with the results. But I will say this, as you watch these bowl games, these players and teams that are able to peak not only physically, but emotionally at the right place, right at kickoff, are the team. That's the challenge. It's kind of like a fine balancing act by a coach and his strength coach, is getting them to be peaking at the perfect time. And that's sometimes not an easy thing to do. It's almost like a chemistry equation that you're trying to figure out. And sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. You live and learn as you go through it. It's kind of a trial and error type of thing.
Let's get into the you talk a little bit about peaking at the right time and these bowl games. You know, granted, we don't have the 40 plus games. And I know there was a huge debate over the last few years on whether, you know, that game on December 23rd matters to people at home. Well, shoot, you know what? It matters to the players. It matters to many people that have been involved in the program leading up to the game. And a year like this, I'm watching Liberty Coastal Carolina, and it matters. And no matter what anybody says, it matters to the guys that are on that field and on the sidelines. What was your impression so far of how these games have played out and the mentality of these teams? You know, and it's not just the semifinal. When you look at the New Year's Six, and I see Carolina versus A&M, Georgia versus Cincinnati, Florida versus Oklahoma, Iowa State versus Oregon. These games are really good matchups. And to many people that are playing on that field, it will matter on that day.
Yeah, I mean, this is a kind of a hot button right now, I think, in the sport, right? I mean, and it's not just COVID. It's not just this year. I think it's a hot button because on social media, they sometimes create a narrative because things can trend and topics can kind of go off on a tangent. And sometimes they become a perception or a misperception. And I think college football right now, the postseason, we talked about this a few weeks ago, is at a crossroads, because I think it's one thing to look at the playoff and sure, we need to tweak the playoff. We definitely need to make it more inclusive to more teams as opposed to just, you know, the seven teams every year. You know, you and I talked about 2024. Okay, we got Ohio State, we got Clemson, we got Alabama, you know, throw in a wild card, Oklahoma, maybe somebody in the Pac-12 accidentally steps in out of there. You know, I'm just kidding, mm-hmm. but you know, I mean, you got seven or eight teams, and that doesn't seem right to any of us. So we got to figure that out. But man, the bowls are such a part of college football, and I feel bad for the players that are being raised in a generation where there is this perception of the bowls don't matter, opt out, who cares, kind of thing. And I guess instead of disagreeing with it because it is what it is, you have to look at it and say, why are we here? To me, it becomes very clear. The fans of Texas A&M or of Texas or Ohio State or Michigan or UCLA or whoever, they could tell you bowl memories off the top of their head going back to the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, right? They could tell you about bowl games from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever it is. And they are invested emotionally into that school. There are players that currently play on those teams that could tell you about some bowl memories that they've really enjoyed as fans of a certain team and now playing in the bowl games. And then there are others that don't really care about that aspect of college football, don't really care about the history of it, don't really look at it like it's a big deal. They're trying to get, you know, to the NFL, and bowl games are unnecessary and irrelevant. And instead of jumping up and down and disagreeing with that notion, you have to realize that exists. There are people that look at it that way. I personally look at it because, again, you just heard me talk about my history. I love bowl games. I think we've really watered down the system. I think, how many bowl games do we normally have? Over 40? Mm-hmm. Is it 50? I don't know how many bowl games there are.
I think it's at 41, I think, this year.
Okay, we're at 41 bowl games. And it really, especially these games before Christmas, it plays into that social media narrative that bowl games don't matter. When you turn on the Myrtle Beach Bowl or the Boca Raton Bowl, and it basically feels like the atmosphere feels like a high school game. That's when you get the eye roll, who cares about bowl games kind of thing. So I think by having so many of them, I think it's hurt the perception of a bowl game. I think when there was, you know, 18 to 20 bowl games, and you had to be about 8-3 or 8-4 to get to a bowl game, oh my gosh, it was a huge celebration. We didn't have as many of them, and it was a big deal to get to a bowl game. Now teams that are 6-6 are going to bowl games. So I think that has cheapened the brand. Not throwing one bowl, I'm saying the bowl structure. It's cheapened what it means to go to a bowl game when we have 41 bowl games and teams that are 6-6 are going to bowl games. Again, let's forget 2020 with COVID when teams that are 3-6 are going. That's obviously an outlier. So I don't know. I don't know how you feel about it. I think that the fans of these teams obviously have great memories because they're invested emotionally. There are a bunch of players that are very, very invested emotionally because it's their blood and sweat out there, and they love going to these bowl games. They love the opportunity to go to them. I think there's bragging rights on the line, whether you agree with that or disagree with that. I mean, when I'm watching Liberty play Coastal Carolina, I really never heard of either one of these schools. I mean, the only reason I really heard of Liberty is Hugh Freeze went there. Mm-hmm. And yet I'm watching every minute of the game. Are they going to win a national championship trophy at the end of it? No. But it was great competition. It was a great game. It was fun to watch. Those teams both wanted to clearly win the game. It had a really bizarre finish, went into overtime. I think the players, they weren't sitting there playing the game saying, what's in this for us? I don't want to be here. This is stupid. Like, they were really enjoying it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was competition. It was one more chance to play a game, one more chance to get bragging rights. And Hugh Freeze's team, you're like, oh, yeah, Cincinnati, Coastal Carolina, you guys keep talking them up. What about, you know, so anyway, there was something there for them. There was incentive there for them. Louisiana, when they played UTSA, I mean, those players were fired up to try to go out and win. So I'm not trying to sell you on bowl games. I'm just trying to tell you the system is hurt because there's so many of them. But there's still great value in bowl games because most, I would say 90%, 95% of the players are thrilled to go to a bowl game. And I think almost all fans, there's not a championship at the end of it in the Final Four, but they just love to watch their team go and play against a team from another conference or another region of the country and say, hey, we play great football from this region. Guess what? Bring it on. Let's see who's going to win. There's a lot of value in that, just in that, just the competition of it. So I'm a fan of the bowl games. I'm not a fan of 41.
I think you nailed it. Like when we're getting in the conversation of the 40s, even the high 30s, like if 30 could be the number and you're picking 60 teams and potentially obviously that in the New Year's Six and the semifinal is a separate conversation, right? But they are included in that conversation. So you're looking at potentially if you take, the 12, let's just say 12 to 14 out of the mix, then you potentially have 44 teams. And you know what? You could still find a way. And again, this year's different, but when you have a team that has two wins and you're in the conversation that has three wins, then what that does is I think it diminishes the bowl aspect. And 2020 is completely different from previous years. So we would never see a 2-8 team or, you know, where South Carolina is getting into a bowl game, getting an invite. But like Liberty and Coastal Carolina, there's not going to be a bunch of NFL players on that roster or on either side. It gives them the opportunity for bragging rights for something that means a hell of a lot to them. For Coastal to finish undefeated, for Liberty looking for the respect that they didn't get in the top 25, and Hugh Freeze talked about that after the game. I look at hypothetically, the season that Army had. Who knows what the type of season they would have next year? They deserve to play in a bowl game. They want to play in a bowl game. It means the world to them because no one's going to the NFL after that experience, right? So when you look at the buildup of how many players can translate to the next level and be drafted, and what we have 253 players, I think, drafted on the weekend of the draft. So you're not going to get the entire lineup at North Carolina. You're not going to get the entire lineup at A&M. You'll get a handful of guys that could play to the next level, but then it's like, hey, those places recruit well enough. If somebody opts out because they want to look at big picture, I would never fault them. But there are enough hungry guys that would still want to play and get the chance to play, or a freshman that says, I want to get the chance to get these practice reps in so I can play in a bowl game because it means the world to me to be on the field for something like this, to get that experience for next year. I think all that stuff plays a huge role during bowl season. It's a springboard to what you want to do into the spring and then into the fall, right? So I think these bowl games and these bowl experiences are not just a conclusion to a career. It is giving you the bridge and the ability for the next season to impress the coaching staff with those extra practices.
Yeah, so, yeah, you're right. And I think, again, just what lens are you looking at it? You know, are you looking at it through the lens of it's playing college football is all about going to the NFL? Then that's one lens. Then you won't care about a bowl game. You know, you're trying to hurry up and get to Phoenix or Miami and start training and get ready for the NFL. If that's your lens, then that's your lens. I see it from just a different lens. I see it more from the college football lens. You can still chase the NFL. I think that's terrific. And I hope every player gets that opportunity. But I look at it because I love college football. I look at it through a lens that the bowl games are awesome. You know, the bowl games give players a big stage and a big opportunity to wear that uniform again and to go out and play with their boys and to go out usually against a team from a different area of the country and play on national TV and get a chance to go out and have some fun playing and trying to go out as a winner. And for the program, you talk about trying to build momentum. That's a lot of times if you're looking at a second tier bowl game, many cases, that's really what it's about. Chance to go out and win. Chance to build momentum into spring football. Nothing like winning a bowl game creates momentum because you usually get a week off and then you start winter conditioning. And nothing gives you makes you feel better about yourself than finishing with a bowl win and going into winter conditioning and then into spring ball. And there's crazy momentum, as crazy as that may sound. There's momentum that gives you going into the next season. So, I love hearing games like Oklahoma and Florida and, you know, West Virginia playing Army and Arkansas and TCU and Cincinnati and Georgia, Texas and Colorado, Oklahoma State, Miami. I mean, those are games that, again, if you're looking at it like with a finger in the air, whoop-de-doo, then that, again, that's fine. But if all we're looking at in college football, if we've gotten to a point in 2020 where all we care about is crowning a national champion and everything else is irrelevant, Are you telling me that's what college football has become? If you're telling me I can't win a national championship, I don't care about it. Doesn't matter. I have no interest in it. Really? that's what college football has become. Meanwhile, until they created a BCS, until they created a playoff, we didn't have a national championship. It was, you know, Nebraska was playing Oklahoma or somebody or Miami in the Orange Bowl, and they were number one, and number two was, let's say, UCLA or USC, and they're playing Michigan or Ohio State in the Rose Bowl. Like, we never really had number one against number two until they created the BCS. And occasionally it might work out in a Fiesta Bowl or an Orange Bowl, but more often than not, the Big Ten and the Pac-10 back then were kind of in their own world, and everybody else was in a different pool. And so the BCS put everybody into the same pool. So, like, this is recent history for fan bases to be completely consumed with a national championship or it's a failure. I have no interest. It goes against everything that this sport has ever been about. It's been about having a great year and, hey, guess what? We didn't win the national championship. We got a chance to get to 10 wins. Or, hey, if we win this game, we got a chance to get to 8 wins. Or, oh my God, first time in school history, if we win this bowl game, we get to 11 wins. Whatever it is. But there's excitement and there's a buzz. And the players, I personally think most of them still feel that. And they get so fired up to go play a different conference for bragging rights to show that region of the country, don't mess with us. I tried to tell you. We play serious football over here, and that's real. I mean, if you go in the locker room, they're feeling that. And whether you're in the Big Ten or the SEC or the Pac-12, the Big 12, the ACC, whatever it is, so go down to the Group of Five, they all feel that sense of pride and pressure to go represent and play. So that's kind of where it is. I enjoy watching the games and look forward to watching these games, not just the playoff. And not just the national championship, which I'll be lucky enough to call them. I'm excited to do that. But I'll be just equally as excited to watch, like I said, some of these West Virginia and Army, crazy as that's in the Liberty Bowl. I mean, if you're a college football fan, how can you not want to watch that game? So that's kind of where I come from with all
I'm
that.
With you. I'm totally with you. And you're right. It's all... The narrative is all about recency bias and what's in the top of our in the last 6-7 years about if you're in the playoff, that's all that matters. No, this sport is built on history, tradition, and now granted, some of it's needs to be adjusted. And we're seeing it in the process play out in a very fluid situation with, name, likeness and image and stuff like that. But the one thing that we all know as fans is we all go back to the tradition of the programs, and we understand what it means to play on New Year's Day and around the bowl situation where, you know, I just look at San Jose State getting the opportunity to cap off what they've been through, right? And those small little stories mean Indiana, they get the chance to go to the Outback Bowl, Iowa State to play in a Fiesta Bowl. Like that's the stuff that means so much to the fan bases that we often overlook and take for granted. And you mentioned the opportunity to call the playoff as well as the national championship, and you're going to be calling Clemson, Ohio State. We'll get to that in a moment. I do want to start here with, you know, what's going on with the Rose Bowl, and obviously the game has moved from Pasadena to Arlington, Texas. But when you look at the line, Notre Dame's coming into this game as the biggest underdog in the history of the playoff, the short history of the playoff, 19.5 points. And when you look at the matchups, everything's all about matchups, right? And we saw that with Dan Mullen taking advantage of Alabama with the mismatches and the speed that he has. When you look at Notre Dame's strength, and it is their offensive line and their tight ends, how can you approach a game like this against Bama? What would be the one thing you would tell Brian Kelly, or you think Brian Kelly should focus on in a game like this when we look at Alabama being so complete on the offensive side and a pretty darn good defense?
Well, I think the thing that he's got to sell to his team is the importance of their mindset. Their mindset when they played Clemson in South Bend was, we're out to prove everybody wrong. They from the opening kickoff on, it was not, let's just kind of put our big toe into this game with Clemson, and who knows, maybe we'll get a sack, or maybe we'll get a turnover, maybe we'll get a field goal. Like, they came into that game with an abrasive attitude. Second play of the game, they did a nice job blocking up front. Kyren Williams scores a long touchdown, and it was almost like a "I told you we could play with these guys" kind of mentality from Kyren Williams, and that resonated throughout the entire game. We could sit there and talk about Clemson didn't have any players. I'm talking more about the Notre Dame attitude. When they went to Athens in 2019, and everybody thought, oh boy, here comes Notre Dame into the heart of the SEC. You know, this is when there was fans at the stadium, sold out stadium in Athens. There's no way they can play with the big boys. And they went toe to toe. And it was a very similar attitude, like, we'll show you kind of attitude. So I think it starts there, because I'll be candid. I think in the ACC championship, it reminded me of the older Notre Dame teams that would get into on a big stage and be like, oh boy. All right, here we go. Let's, we can do this, guys. I think we can. Come on, let's do this. They were very tentative, and Clemson was not, and Clemson exposed them. And I think the mindset of going against Alabama, you get out there, you look down across the other side of the 50, and there's Nick Saban. There he is. Wow, there's Nick Saban. There's that Alabama uniform. Wow, there's Devontae Smith. Ooh, look at Najee Harris. He's bigger than I thought. Look, he's bigger in person. Look, check him out. Like, you can't be like that. You have got to have your mind ready to shock the world, believe in one another. And so that sounds like a basic thing. It's really not easy to do when you're playing Nick Saban in Alabama, because since these guys were, 8 years old, and they've turned on college football playoffs or big bowl games, there's Nick Saban, there's Alabama. And now you're on the field with them. So you have to get over that part of the matchup. XO-wise, if I'm Notre Dame, I'm thinking about Ian Book on early downs, play action, let his creativity work, let these bigger receivers, they're not going to outrun the Alabama secondary, but we can scheme them up. You know, we can give them pre-snap looks. And all of a sudden, we're going to shift two tight ends, and then we're going to motion receiver. Then we're going to bring the back out of the backfield. I want to make Alabama's defense think and have to adjust. I'm not just going to line up and play against Alabama's defense. I'm going to give them a lot of different personnel groupings. I'm going to use my tight ends. I'm going to line them up as three tight ends, and then I'm going to yell, you know, move. And then all of a sudden, one of the tight ends was lined up to the right. Now he's a receiver off to the right. One of the tight ends was to the left. He's now a fullback, and the other tight end stays. And now we're in a completely different personnel grouping because of that versatility. That may sound like nothing to you, but as a defensive player, you go from a what we would call a 13 personnel, one back, three tight ends look, to all of a sudden, boom, 24 goes out as a receiver, 87's now in a fullback, and 89 stays at a tight end. You can add the linebackers and the safeties are looking at each other. They got to all be on the same page. So I would do that as much as possible. Move, make Alabama think, try to get them to bust a coverage. I would not run the ball on first and 10, run the ball. I would do that, but I would really rely on my veteran. The strength of my offense is Ian Book. Put the ball in his hands, play action on early downs, break tendencies, do as much as I can, because I think Alabama, you can move the ball against that secondary, and they don't have an elite pass rush. But if you wait to throw on third and seven, you're not, it's going to be a long night. So that's what I would do. Personnel groupings, a lot of shifts, a lot of motions, a lot of different formations. Make Alabama, if Alabama starts to look at each other and trying to communicate, or they're looking to the sideline, that's exactly what I want to see if I'm a Notre Dame fan, because we got them thinking, we got them a bit on their heels. If they're digging into their cleats and they know what's coming, you have no chance of moving the ball against Alabama. You got to get them to think, and you got to get them to adjust, and you got to hopefully get them to bust a coverage and make them pay for it, because you're not going to outrun them. It's not a game that lines itself up that way, but you can confuse them. And that's part of the strength of the versatility of those tight ends and what this offense can do. But if they win or they're competitive, Ian Book on early downs will be a big factor with his scrambling and play action passes and getting some matchups that are favorable to the Notre Dame offense. That's that side of the ball. The other side of the ball is they're in trouble.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot I can tell you, because their secondary is vulnerable. Their corners are vulnerable. And if you don't use the safeties to help over top against those corners, against the receivers that Bama has, then you're gonna give up some huge plays to Devontae Smith. So the safeties are gonna have to roll wherever six is. They're gonna have to always have a bracket or a double coverage on Devontae Smith, which means the running game of Najee Harris could be huge. And then it'll free up John Mitchie to have some one-on-one opportunities. And then he potentially can have a big game. But they'll be determined with this much time. Clark Lee's a brilliant mind, the defense coordinator who's headed to Vandy to become the head coach. He'll do everything he can to bracket Devontae Smith, to take him away. And it may work, but it's just going to open up other opportunities, like I said, for Najee Harris in the run game, and then Mechie and those tight ends that they have, which are, you know, a lethal combination of what they can do. Sark, to me, I don't know who won the Frank Broyles Award, but Steve Sarkisian should win it after losing Jalen Waddle, everybody being concerned. You know, I kid David Pollack that they're done, you know, without Jalen Waddle. If anything, they've maintained their level of consistency, maybe even gone up better. And to lose the most explosive player in the country, and no one's even talking about that anymore, Steve Sarkisian deserves that Frank Broyles Award. I think that matchup, Sark against Clark Lee, will be a lot of fun to watch. But I just don't like Notre Dame's chances on that side of the ball, slowing down Bama.
Yeah. The only thing that Notre Dame must do to keep this a game is they've got to have long drives, right, on offense. Yeah. And basically, you're playing keep away. You're helping your defense by keeping them off the field. If you could sustain any type of long drives, that just allows Bama's offense to sit there and just wait and watch and wonder. And because when they're going to get on the field, just a perfect example. Now, granted, I know Florida has a lot of questions on their defense. Was just the way the final minute played out in the first half of the SEC championship game when Florida scored. And you're like, they just scored way too early, because here comes Alabama in 65 seconds, right? Remarkable.
Let me make sure the fans know, in case they haven't watched a ton of Alabama, you're going to hear a lot about Devontae Smith. You're going to hear about Najee Harris, Mac Jones. I mean, all those guys are like Heisman finalists. You know, they're tremendous. I guess Najee didn't make it as a fighter. He didn't make it as a final. He's top five.
So he's the top four, and he finished fifth. Yep.
Yeah. So you got three of the five finalists on this Alabama offense. But the guy that Notre Dame fans need to be aware of is a name you're not going to think much about. It's Jaleel Billingsley, number 19. He's their tight end H-back. And as I go back to the defense being so concerned about Devontae Smith, and they should be, it's not just Mechie that ends up making plays for him. And of course, Najee Harris, or even a Slade Bolden. It's Billingsley. This guy is a tremendous young tight end that they'll find a way to get him matched up one-on-one. And he's just got too much speed and too much size. He's 6'4", 230. I think he's bigger than that now. But 19 will be a guy in this game that if I were Notre Dame, I'd be very, very concerned about trying to match up with.
Yeah, pick your poison, right? If you contain Harris, you slow down Smith, and then they're going to hit you with Mechie and Billingsley. Good luck spreading that around for Mac Jones. All right, let's go to the other side. And I think at the beginning of the season, I think if we were going to have a season, it felt like as soon as the national championship was over a year ago and we found out who was coming back, it felt like, hey, we've got three of the top four teams already coming back, and that would be Alabama, Ohio State, and Clemson. And then Notre Dame was the wild card here, right, and getting into that conversation in the top four. And I think everybody wanted to see potentially a rematch because that Fiesta Bowl was one of the best. I mean, I say this many times here on this podcast, and I say it on the air as well, that being on the field of that game was incredible because the hitting was fantastic. I mean, it was such a good game, and Buckeye fans will just want to just, you know, roll over because the idea that they were robbed a couple times, because they were. But the way those two teams went back and forth, and the way 16 came back and was physical between the tackles, when you talk about Chase Young on the field, and the way Justin Fields was driving down the field, and he's picked off by a guy, Nolan Turner, who we won't see in the first half of this game. We finally get that rematch, and I'm surprised here that the line has been around 6.5, 7.5 favoring Clemson. Your initial thoughts here on a game like this, and the biggest questions that you have for Clemson and Ohio State in the rematch?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm with you. Last year's game, LSU was getting a lot of attention, but I think everybody was really excited to see who would win the Ohio State-Clemson game because, you know, the winner matching up, imagining them against LSU was going to be exciting. And I think Ohio State really had a team when you throw in Chase Young and Damon Arnett and Jeffrey Okuda. I mean, you're talking about some elite players on the defensive side of the football, especially the two corners. It ended up being first rounders. And you think about what Clemson had, and most of those players are back. When ETN decided to come back, and of course Trevor had to come back, they lost Isaiah Simmons and Kayvon Wallace, A.J. Terrell. But for the most part, Clemson brings a lot of the same players back. They lost, by the way, they did lose offensive linemen from last year. So you look at them on film this year, and there are enough pieces on both sides of the ball to get you really excited, because when those teams walked off the field last year, you really felt like the better team didn't necessarily win that night. Ohio State didn't necessarily take advantage of some opportunities. I know there's some controversial calls, you know, the T. Higgins fumble we can talk about forever. I still don't understand the rule. I just need to understand the rule, because to me, you know, a football move that looked like a fumble and a scoop and score that would have been the difference in the game. But if you look at Ohio State in the first half, they were dominating the game. I mean, J.K. Dobbins first quarter had 141 yards rushing in the first quarter, and Ohio State was inside the red zone in the first half three times and came away with three field goals. So there, we could spin that game, but the point is, there teams left the field, and especially in Ohio State's side, they were frustrated. They were angry. I'm sure they used that score and video clips of that game, not just to prep for this game, but the entire spring practice and summer and COVID and everything they had to get through. This game was a reminder of how painful their season ended. And now here they are, you know, with a chance to match up against Trevor Lawrence with a very different team. I mean, Ohio State comes into this game without Chase Young, without Damon Arnett, without Jeffrey Okuda, without Malik Harrison. It's a very, very different team. And to be candid, they played six games – And if you've watched them play almost every game that they played, it's kind of left you scratching your head with their defense. You know, I think the Ohio State offense has been a little erratic and not as consistent as we thought they would be with the way they could throw the football. And they've had to deal with some issues with COVID, with some offensive linemen initially. Then they lost Olave in the Big Ten championship game. Justin Fields has not quite been as consistent with his decision-making, put the ball in the coverage a few times against Indiana and then again against Northwestern, which is very uncharacteristic for him. But the Ohio State defense, that's the mystery coming into this game. Their secondary is incredibly vulnerable, and especially in man-to-man coverage. And teams have not been avoiding Sean Wade. They've been trying to find him. Where's 24? Oh, there he is. Let's go right there. And I don't think it'll be any different with Clemson. So for 12 days to prepare, and Jeff Hafley is no longer the defensive coordinator. He's now the head coach of Boston College. And now you've got Kerry Coombs that came back to Ohio State from the Tennessee Titans. They're trying to, you know, six games in, people can talk about what an advantage it is for Ohio State to only play six games. If you've watched him, I look at it completely opposite. I think it's a disadvantage because they don't know who they are yet. You get to play 11 or 12 games, and as a defense, you can gel together. You can learn, oh, okay, that doesn't work. That does work. He can do this. He can't do that. Oh, he's getting better at this. And 12 games later, you have a better idea of who you are. Ohio State comes into a semifinal game against Clemson and Trevor Lawrence and Travis Etienne. And about the only thing they really know is their inside defensive linemen are elite. Garrett, 92. Togi, 72. Elite players on the inside. I mean, they will be formidable against Clemson. Their defensive ends have a chance. They don't have Chase Young, but they have a chance. Tyreek Smith's a very, very solid player. Jonathan Cooper's another very, very solid player. So they're good there. The linebackers have played in a million games. Pete Warner, Tuff Borland, Baron Browning. Those guys have played. The question is the secondary. Will Ohio State play better? They'll have to compete. Or will they get exposed and give up over 350 to 400 yards passing to Trevor Lawrence? That's the mystery to me in this game is, can Ohio State affect Lawrence? Can they get pressure on him? Can they slow down Travis Etienne? And then most importantly, how do they play against an offense that can score in the blink of an eye with the receivers that they have? That's going to be, they can play to a level that we've not seen. Again, they've only played six games. If you ask Kerry Coombs, he doesn't know his defense yet, six games in. So that's the other side that you could spin on. They only played six games. What an advantage. Like I said, I'm looking at it very, very differently. I think it's a disadvantage because they don't know who they are on this side of the ball. And maybe they play lights out. Maybe the competition, the negativity surrounding them, they only played six games, they don't deserve to play, all that stuff. The fact they lost to Clemson the way they did a year ago, maybe all that will get them so juiced up that they will play at a level that they've not shown all year. All I can tell you is if they play the way they have all year, they will not stop Clemson's offense. So they're going to have to play at a different level to have a chance of slowing down Trevor Lawrence and Etienne and Cornell Powell and Amari Rodgers and all the speed that Clemson has.
How do you process, you know, with 22 players out because of contact tracing or COVID? We don't know specifics there in that Northwestern game. And Fields didn't look right without Chris Olave out there. And Fields afterwards talked about his thumb. You know, Ryan Day downplayed it, but Fields afterwards brought up that he may have sprained his thumb. Any concern? And this goes back to what I brought up earlier in the podcast where, you know, you have 13 days. You don't have that 3 to 4 week built in time where you can get healthy. Right. Any concern with Fields there throwing the football in a game like this?
Well, we're not going to know the answer to that until we see him out in the field. He mm-hmm. and his coach have made it sound as if it's going to be okay by then. I don't, you know, they're saying sprained thumb. When I hear sprained thumb on your throwing hand, it makes me feel like you know, let's ice it, let's rest it. But how do I ice it? Or I can ice it. How do I rest it when I've only got 12 days to get ready to play it at this game of this magnitude? So I don't know how they, you know, they've done that. I don't know how they've rested it and at the same time practice to get the rhythm. You want to maintain your rhythm. And in his case, you want to get back into your rhythm that he's had, you know, earlier in the year. And so, and I got a ton, I think anybody should have a ton of confidence in who Justin Fields is and who he can be in this game. You know, I think the emergence of Trey Sermon over the last few games, and especially in the Big Ten Championship, is vitally important to Ohio State going up against Brent Venables. Brent Venables, the defense coordinator from Clemson, has great players, but he's very active, gives you a lot of different looks. And if you're a one-dimensional attack, it makes it really hard. And that's why last year's game, I mentioned J.K. Dobbins, he went off. Remember, he had an ankle injury in that game, but before getting tweaked, he had so many big plays in that game, and they threw the ball to him out of the backfield. And I think Trey Sermon has got to become that guy. He ran at a different level, with different acceleration and lateral quicks than we'd seen really all year. He looked like a guy that was still recovering from that ACL most of the year. But to his credit, man, he got healthy and confident in the system and took off. Clemson, you know, their defense is athletic. The inside is physical. Tyler Davis, Brzee, the new freshman, is fun to watch in the interior. James Skalski, man, if there's a guy that's more vital to his defense in the country, I don't know who it is. I mean, we saw how Clemson looked defensively against Notre Dame without Skalski, and we saw the Notre Dame game in the ACC championship with Skalski in there. He's just the best way to say it, and some middle linebackers that play a lot are this way. He's that guy. He's a quarterback. He's an extension of Brent Venables. He gets them lined up. He's aggressive. He's nasty. He's got a chip on his shoulder. He's perfect. I mean, he's exactly what you want. So you want to keep an eye on 47 for that Clemson defense. But I tell you, the matchup in the passing game is, does Fields have time to throw? Because Olave and Garrett Wilson can make plays against this secondary. But will he have time to throw? Will he have to get out and create, which he's very capable of doing? Last year when he played Clemson, he had a huge knee brace on his left leg. He was playing at maybe 60% as far as his legs were concerned. He's now 100%. So his legs, design QB run, zone read, quarterback scramble, that'll be much, much more prevalent than it was when these two teams played last year. But to me, Justin Fields holds the key to this game on how well he plays or how ineffective, whichever it is, if Ohio State's going to keep pace with Trevor Lawrence, who I think is going to score. It's going to be up to Fields and his offensive line to give him time. If he has time to throw, I think Olave and Garrett Wilson can make plays against the Clemson secondary. It's just a matter of whether or not he has time to do it.
Herbie, you know, there's another backstory to this off the field, especially, and you know both coaches well, and that is Dabo and Ryan Day. And Dabo hasn't been shy. You know, he's been very vocal, talking about, you know, Ohio State, and it's not a knock against Ohio State. It's just not playing enough games. And obviously in this final coaches poll, having Ohio State ranked 11th, and he said, it doesn't matter if it's Ohio State. It's just, they didn't play enough games. I didn't feel like they deserved to be in the top 10. And then, you know, he's got quotes, coming out today while we're taping this by saying, you know, how people in the state would view him in Ohio. And he said, I could probably run for governor of Michigan and win. So he understands what's going on. And then you got Ryan Day inside the locker room and saying, you know, we're giving a message to his team. And there was somebody that recorded it. And I can't believe it was put out there because it's something that's internal. And it was played out that they were going to kick the blank out of whoever they play when it comes to the playoff. What do you make of this back and forth between these guys? And it's, again, not a personal back and forth, but the messaging that is being sent out there by both coaches right now.
Yeah, I mean, Dabo is, to his credit, he's sticking to his guns on principle. I mean, this has nothing to do with Ohio. It's not like he's evaluating Ohio State and their tape and saying, oh, I think they're about the 11th best team in the country. This is strictly on principle. And if you know Dabo at all, if his own brother or a family member were coaching a team that played six games, if he and his team, that's what I would love to see. If Dabo himself and his team played six games this year and Ohio State had played 11, where would he put Clemson? You know, would he put them on principle at 11? Part of me thinks he would. Part of me thinks that he would honestly look at that on principle and say that they should be 11. Now, they would probably still get the benefit of the doubt the way Ohio State did. But I think that's how, when he has conviction about a topic, he's not going to bend. It's just, he's a man of principle. And so Ohio State's going to spin it into, not only should we have beaten them a year ago and we got jobbed on a few calls, but now their coach is saying we're the 11th best team in the country. Can you believe that? That's how they're going to spin it. You can guarantee that. And they should. I mean, coaches always are looking for reasons to get their team to collectively get fired up and to get angry. And, you know, Ryan Day has an easy job this time around to get his team ready for Clemson. He's just trying to make sure they're not too emotional going up against Clemson. So, but again, one thing I can assure you, Dabo Swinney doesn't do anything publicly without really thinking it through and about how things are going to be perceived. You think he didn't think it through? We're about to play Ohio State. They're asking me to release my coach's poll that's going to be public. He knew he was going to play Ohio State before he released his final poll. So he still put Ohio State at 11. So he didn't accidentally submit that with Ohio State at 11. He could have very easily put Ohio State at 3 or at 4 or wherever he wanted. He intentionally put them at 11, knowing that he was going to get questions and knowing that Ryan Day and Ohio State and their fans and their players are going to get fired up about it. And he still put them at 11. And if you listen to his answer, he's being honest. It has everything to do with, they, in my mind, didn't qualify. These other teams that had to play more games went through more wear and tear. They're more deserving. They should be up there. And that's why he has Ohio State. It has nothing to do. It's not that he's watching film and saying, oh, these guys suck. I'm going to move them all the way down to 11. It's not that. It's that they didn't play enough games and that they shouldn't qualify. That's his view of it. By the way, I didn't talk to you and David after this all this talk about Ohio State. Should they be in? Should they not? If the number of games was going to be in question like this for everybody, then what Bill Hancock and the CFP should have done is, through this unprecedented times of COVID and the Big Ten and the Pac-12 not playing. Oh, now they are playing, but they've got a tight schedule and they've got eight games. But if any of their players get dinged, they're going to be out 21 days and they have no weeks on the back end. They're backed up right to it. So they're going to, they miss games, they're going to miss games. There's no chance to postpone them and play them later. And knowing that, they should have just come out and said, in order to qualify, before one game was played, in order to qualify for the 2020 CFP, you have to play at least blank games, whether it was six, whether it was eight, whether it was 10, whatever it was. They should have said it before the season started. Then everybody would have known the score of the game. Everybody would have known, oh, the Pac-12 and the Big Ten, they have to play eight games or they're out. And you could have argued that point, but at least we would have known before the season started. By not saying anything, it just left everybody to wonder what the committee's going to do. Ohio State, they might only end up with five goals. They might, oh, they're going to play six total. Okay, what's the committee going to do with six games? It left it more chaotic than if they just would have come out at the beginning of the season and said, I know this is a crazy time. You may not agree with this, but as a unit, as a group, we've decided that you have to play eight games to qualify for this year's playoff, or whatever the number would have been. And then I think we at least all would have known what the mark was. And if you got to it, great. And if you didn't, sorry, you're out. But once they did not do that, everybody needs to just deal with it and accept it. The committee voiced their opinion. they collectively felt that Ohio State was worthy of a top four finish, and that's it. That's where they're ranked, and we move on. We accept it. And what are you going to do? Jump up and down and argue it? I mean, it is what it is. And it's, to me, it would have saved us a lot of grief if they would have made this announcement before the season started. Then everybody wouldn't be speculating and getting upset about it.
Completely agree with you. That actually, that's the first time I'm hearing that. And that should have been a requirement from the beginning. So coming in and these conferences, when they make the decisions on potentially returning, they have an idea and a concept. Okay, this is what we're facing if we're playing football and we want to get one of our members involved in the playoff conversation. There's a minimum that we have to meet here, and the ability that if they do not have a game that weekend that got canceled or postponed and they're healthy, that they could schedule somebody else outside of conference and figure it out so we meet the qualifications for the games being played. And by leaving it for interpretation for everybody, it brought up a lot more questions and conversations and then comments like the reference to Dabo for the interpretation on whether you should be considered in the playoffs. So I completely agree.
Kevin, I think we should finish it with this. If you look at the AP poll and you look at the coaches poll, it was, you may have some that voted them here, voted Ohio State there, but I don't think the committee is necessarily out of line with what the others voted and how they ranked them. I mean, if you look at it, it's very, very similar to what you saw from the coaches and the AP. I think the AP had Ohio State, what, at 3? When the season ended, mm-hmm. The coaches poll had Ohio State at 3. They had Notre Dame at 4. So the AP and the coaches. So if you want to be upset with everybody. Don't be upset with the system. The coaches, the guys that know, the only thing we heard about was what Dabo Swinney did with his poll. That as a group, the coaches put Ohio State at 3. The AP, all the people that vote in the AP, they have Ohio State at 3. The college football rankings, they have Ohio State at 3. So it's unanimous from all the different views of this sport that have Ohio State at 3. So evidently it's not preferential treatment for Ohio State. If Ohio State and the AP were 6 and the coaches poll, they were 7 and the college football rankings, they were 3. Then we could really say, oh my gosh, what in the world is going on? How does the committee have them at 3 and the rest of civilization has them at 6 and 7? But that's not the case. AP, 3. Coaches poll, 3. And the CFP rankings, 3. So it's a lot of noise for nothing in my mind. They got the benefit of the doubt by every human eyeball that watches the sport.
I'm 100% with you, Herbie. And, you know, the best part of it is that the one thing that we can count on no matter what this year in this craziness is that we will have bowl games of consequence on New Year's Day. And I love that we have that continued tradition. Looking forward to the call in New Orleans, of course, for the Sugar Bowl featuring Clemson, Ohio State, and Alabama, Notre Dame. Which is the Rose Bowl, and you can catch those games on ESPN. A big thank you to Taylor Schwenk as well, our producer, and making sure we can continue this podcast throughout 2020. We've had a lot of craziness with the schedules and during a pandemic, and Taylor's held it together this entire year, and looking forward to 2021. And for our audience, thank you for your continued support. It's been great doing this consistently on Mondays and Wednesdays throughout most of the year. And we appreciate your loyalty and getting you ready for college football weekend. We hope that you have a great and safe new year as we close out and say goodbye, thankfully, to 2020. And let's bring on some positive vibes in 2021. If you want more college football, stay safe, social distance, wear a mask, take care.